welcome to the Alliance podcast. My name is James Allen. I'm the Director of Policy, Governance and External Affairs here at the Sport and Recreation Alliance. Today's podcast is about mental health with a particular focus on elite and professional sport. And I'm delighted to be joined by Ian Braid. Ian, as many of you will know, is the founder and managing director of Dockyer Sport and is passionate about mental health, passionate about sport, and is joining us to share some reflections on the elite and pro sport system. Ian, would you like to introduce yourself to listeners before we get into the meat of the topic?
Yes, I would. Thank you very much. I have spent over 15 years in sport. I've been a participant, but I've also been a trustee, a non-executive director of a national governing body. I've sat on the management board of Sport Resolutions UK, and I have been the chief executive officer of the British Athletes Commission. So I think I've got quite a broad church in terms of my experience in sport, and now run a company, Dockyer Sport, Duty of Care in Action, which amongst other things looks at mental health in sport as a key deliverable of the review undertaken by Baroness Tanny Gray Thompson. As chief executive of the British Athletes Commission, it was my duty and responsibility to look after athlete welfare, and mental health was extremely high on my personal and professional agenda. What I now reflect on, having left the BAC, the British Athletes Commission, is that sport has a wider duty of care to other people in the sector and their mental health. And I think specifically about administrators, coaches, performance directors and officials. So there's a lot of work to do in this space, and the more we can talk about it, the better.
Thanks very much, Ian. And if we could kind of start with where you left us there in your introduction. My view is that this issue around mental health has become hugely more prominent in recent years, both within society more generally and within sport. I think the way we talk about mental health in terms of the level of knowledge that we have collectively, the level of sensitivity that we have, the level of maturity we have, has developed enormously. So certainly the sort of conversation we're having today, the work that you do with your company, I just don't think would have existed even 5 years ago. Am I right to have that reflection, or is that perhaps slightly wishful thinking that things are moving on quite quickly?
No, I think things are moving on, but I wonder sometimes whether it's joined up moving on, and it's good in parts and weak in others. If you particularly look at the DCMS report on mental health, due to the work of the BAC, mental health of elite athletes was very, very prominent. But from my own experience as a chief exec, and more latterly in my company, I know that the mental health of coaches, administrators, perhaps officials, needs a lot more work as well for us to be applying a duty of care within sport so that we can help society.
And just on that point, and thinking initially about elite and professional sport specifically, has the extent to which we've pursued what you might call a winner-takes-all mentality, has that, and the undoubted success that's come with that, has that been the consequence of mental health issues being neglected? Have we historically got that balance wrong, where we've pursued medal success, for example, instead of a more rounded view of what success actually is, which includes mentally healthy athletes, who I'm sure you would probably argue are actually more likely to be successful in the long term anyway. But it does feel a little bit that we've focused on one type of success and neglected that slightly broader concept of athlete and broader welfare within sport.
Well, I think you're right. The work the BAC did, and I took part in, was very much about elite athletes at the very top of the talent pathway. It wasn't looking at the mental health of athletes lower down, on all those that drop off. So the duty of care to those people, then there is the duty of care within a high performance system, very often then also within a bubble. It's high performance, it's geared to excellence, it's geared to success. The stigma that exists about mental health in sport, I think, is amplified in high performance sport, and it's a weakness, and therefore the athletes have often struggled to speak out, which is why the role of the BAC was fundamental. But I think the view about athletes and performance sport and medals was perhaps typified by the athlete medical scheme, which does what it says on the tin, but was very much more geared to the physical recovery and rehab of athletes who were injured, and made no provision until 2014 about mental health. So we are playing catch up still.
So what you've just said there is really quite striking to me. And so, just for my clarity, pre-2014, the area of elite sport that you're involved in essentially had very limited or no provision around the mental health of athletes at all. Given that we spend an awful lot of time thinking about sports psychology, marginal gains, and I think we all understand that mental edge is such an important part of sporting performance, why do you think we got into a position as a sector where we were just neglecting that to such an extent as recently as 4 years ago?
I think you'd have to ask the people that were delivering the system at that time. Because of the stigma, I don't think athletes were willing to come forward because they would potentially lose their funding or lose their selection. The BAC didn't exist in any high profile with any meaning about athlete welfare until 2013. And I think it's interesting that there was sports psychology, but there wasn't psychology support. And particularly where you've got athletes who are worried about their position all of the time, very lonely whether you're in a squad or not, then if they felt they wanted to talk to a psych, well, sometimes those psychs used to turn up in the branded livery of the national governing body. And secondly, they weren't exclusively for James Allen, the elite athlete. They were working with James Allen, Ben Jessop, Ian Braid, etc., etc. And there was a underlying concern, I think, in many athletes that why would I tell my weaknesses and my fallibilities to a sports psych who might share it around? And there just was a lack of trust and faith and confidence, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just like to thank you for referring to me as an elite athlete. I think that's probably the first and last time that's ever going to happen.
I think that's true.
In the course of my career. But moving swiftly on from that, I think you know far more about this than I do, but elite sport, professional sport, is clearly exceptional in many ways. It's an unusual lifestyle. I think it's a lifestyle which comes with huge privileges and also very unique and very real pressures. But a lot of the things that we're talking about here around stigma, sensitivity, access to good quality services, those are not just issues within that part of the sector, or indeed within the sports sector, are they? I think the lack of willingness that people have to talk to their employers about their mental health is very widespread. I think stigma around mental health is still very widespread. Are there any lessons you think that could be transferred from the progress within elite sport, where I do think this issue is being tackled far more effectively than it used to, for the rest of us, if you like, those of us who are involved at more of a grassroots level, and also for us in our more general lives and the interactions that we have with people? Do you think there are things that have gone well that you would transplant or transfer into other places?
Well, I think I might, if I may, take issue with you slightly about what's gone on in elite performance, because I still think there is a vulnerability to coaches, performance directors, and indeed the people that provide, you know, physios aren't necessarily trained in mental health awareness or mental health first aid, and yet they have one of the most intimate environments. And I know from experience, having worked with athletes, about when that goes wrong, how catastrophic that could be. So I think there's still a lot of work to do at the performance end, rather than just focusing on the athletes. That was the success of lobbying by the BAC. There's nobody lobbying for the coaches, or there hasn't been historically. And I just think performance sport, and in fact people who run NGBs at the top level, it is an aggregation of very lonely people. And what we can learn, and what I try and do by example, is talk about mental health and not judgmental. And I just learned so much about mental health through my own experiences and working with athletes. And I think until such time that sport gets its own mental health in order across the piece, whatever your role, and I come back to that point, administrator, coach, official particularly, if we haven't got any officials either at the top end of sport or on Hackney Marshes on a Sunday afternoon because they're getting abused, we haven't got any sport. So we have got to get our wider house in order before we can perhaps transfer lessons to other side of society, in my view.
Something else you said then which struck a chord with me, and I'd just like to look at it in a slightly different context, is about loneliness. And I often think that leadership looks quite lonely, and I often think that professional sport looks quite lonely too, in a very exposing place. One of the loneliest looking people that I've seen in recent months is Steve Smith, and clearly there has been a very high profile incident of cheating within Australian cricket, very serious, dealt with I think pretty swiftly, and I think in many ways dealt with quite successfully. One of the things that struck me though is the great joy that people in the media in this country were taking in his misfortune, and the fact that he was clearly in distress as a result of the revelations that had come out. I'm not saying that I don't think he should be banned, I'm not really commenting on that. I'm not saying what he did was right, because it wasn't. But did you have a view at the time on whether there was any kind of care for his mental health, his well-being, the players around him, his family?
I think it's a great question. What sport does for society, without getting into the philosophy of it, is about values, sense of right and wrong, teamship, etc., etc. So I think that's one side of it. I was very much struck by the circus that was following a distraught Steve Smith to the gate at Johannesburg Airport. And I looked at him then, and he was dressed all in white. So there was no Cricket Australia branding, no sponsorship logos, no nothing, and there was nobody else around him. And it is for other people to judge the severity of the punishment Smith, Bancroft, Warner, etc. should get. But I saw a very vulnerable man there. And so that was on the way to the plane. He would have sat on that plane for however long it takes to get from Joburg to Sydney, knowing that was a press conference at the other end, and had to deal with that. And I didn't know who the guy was who kindly tapped him on the shoulder when he started to cry. It was his father, as we now know. And there weren't a lot of other people standing by his side. And I feel for him now. And I do hope that, you know, in many cases where wrong has been done, be it criminally or morally, people have a time to reflect and come back stronger.
I agree, and I sometimes think that as someone who loves sport, plays sport, has been obsessed by sport in many forms all my life really, it's quite easy to lose perspective, and I do think he's done something wrong, but equally I was, as I said, incredibly uncomfortable with the clear joy that people were taking, and it was all over social media, both in this country and in Australia. And I think to see someone who is in that state, who is actually a relatively young man as well in terms of life experience,
28,
isn't a hugely experienced person, who for whatever reason has made a serious misjudgment, and I would suspect a lot of that is about the culture of the dressing room, the sport. I don't think that if we didn't have that kind of obsessive winner-takes-all mentality, this would necessarily have happened. And it is an opportunity to think further up the chain about why did that happen? Why do these things more generally happen? Are they the product of a healthy culture that's thinking about people's well-being? I'd suggest perhaps it's not.
I would agree with you. I think you're back to being in performance bubbles. So you see life through a narrow lens. The lens you look through is one of sporting excellence, but you don't necessarily easily see the bigger picture. And I think where potentially performance sport has been poor in the past has been, you know, almost an exclusive focus on, if you want to make the boat go faster, you concentrate on your sport. You do not do anything else other than eat, sleep, train, repeat. And I think there again we have that obligation, which I think a lot of people are addressing now at the performance lifestyle team Joe Harrison runs in EIS, and there are organisations that are doing a lot of good work in the transition space. We're getting that moral obligation better, and I think we're creating better people as well as better athletes.
And that's obviously great to hear, and I think that takes us back to where we started today and thinking back on some of the progress that we've made as well, because I absolutely accept that there's more to do, but I do think we need to give ourselves a degree of credit as a sector in terms of the progress that we have actually made. I'm not going to ask you to put a date on this because it would be completely kind of artificial and impossible really, but if we took the last say 4 or 5 years as a period of time where we've seen a level of progress, how far into the future do you think we will be looking to when we make our next kind of leap forward? So when it's no longer exceptional to have an athlete talking about their mental health, but that's absolutely commonplace. Do you think that's something that's happening within the next 5 years, within our lifetimes, within the period of our career? Where do you kind of feel that energy is going to come from as well, and what's the next big leap?
Well, yet again, you come back and you focus on athletes. The big leap for me is chief execs of national governing bodies, anybody that's under the influence of the funding model as it exists, right? If they feel comfortable enough to talk about stress, anxiety, depression, and they feel they're supported, then I think that's the quantum leap. I look again at officials. I mean, I know, for instance, the University of Portsmouth is just about to try and embark on a piece of work looking at the mental health of officials who are in many sports subject to abuse. We've got to get that stuff nailed, and that's the quantum leap for me. We need to move on from just talking about high performance athletes, however important that is, to taking a more broader view about the mental health of sport.
Thank you very much, Ian, and I'd just like to wrap up our session today, where we've talked a lot about elite and professional sport, with one more question, if I may. You called me an elite athlete earlier, which is very kind. I think one thing I have been quite good at over the course of my life is being a sports fan, and I think that the culture that's set by fans and behaviour that you see in and around football stadia, rugby, cricket, all major spectator sports, I think is actually really important in the athlete and player welfare issue. It's also important in culture, and it's important in behaviour that's kind of normalised and considered acceptable. Even 25 years ago or a bit more, when I started regularly going to sporting events, the kind of comments that you would hear shouted out to an extent around race, although I think a lot of progress had been made already by that point, certainly around sexuality, would not be considered acceptable now, and I'm very pleased to say I don't think they happen very often now. How are we going to get to a point where similar kind of sensitivity and knowledge is shared around mental health issues? Because we've seen a number of instances of where, particularly in football but in other sports too, very unfortunate comments around mental health have been made, and people have found it funny. And I'm not seeking to judge people for that, because I think it's an education issue, but is there any kind of energy and drive, do you think, to tackle those kind of issues so the whole atmosphere around the sporting event driven by fans is actually a bit more positive?
I think it's work in progress. I think people are, and I would include myself in this, sometimes clumsy with their language. And, you know, the phraseology of the youth of today, you know, picks up words which would offend people of an older generation. I believe that the Football League is going to have a charity sponsor, which is Mind, for the next 2 years. And I think that's absolutely brilliant, because I think if they have half the success that the Prostate Cancer Initiative did, which got men to talk about something else they don't want to talk about, then I think that's a great start. And I'm delighted for Mind, and I'm delighted that the Football League has had the vision to take that on.
I completely agree, and it's great to end on such a positive note. We're very excited as partners of both of those organisations to see them coming together. I think the potential of that partnership to really drive some of these conversations across all Football League clubs is absolutely enormous. So thank you for highlighting, and great to end on such a positive note.